You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
We are thrilled to have this opportunity, and I'm especially thrilled to be here tonight with my friend and brother and client, Ian Manuel. And I just, Ian, before we even get started, I'm trying not to get too emotional, but I have to say, seeing you on this screen after where you've been, where we first met, seeing that beautiful pink background, because that was never a color they used in any of the Florida State prisons where you are. I've even got my pink shirt on, so we're already in harmony. But I just have to say how extraordinary and wonderful it is that you have taken the time to document what you've been through, to tell this powerful story, and to allow people like the folks who are here tonight to learn more about what you've been through, what you've experienced, and what it means. I just want to start by asking, how are you doing, man? How are things going?
It's intense. It's intense. It's been cathartic to write my story, but it's a lot of pressure because you have to tell it over and over and over again to people who haven't heard it before. So it's been a roller coaster, man. But I'm enjoying the ride.
Good, 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 good. Well, we're going to talk about some things tonight that maybe we haven't talked publicly about before, if that's so, that's okay.
Okay.
You know, most people need to understand the context that surrounded you when you were a little boy. So the prison population has been stable throughout most of the 20th century, about 200,000 people in jails and prisons. And then in the early 70s, all of the politicians start preaching what I call the politics of fear and anger. And they want to just put everybody in jail or prison. They say that people who are drug addicted and drug dependent are criminals, and we need to put them in jail and prison. They don't say that's a health problem that needs a healthcare response. And then they start saying that children should be put in jails and prisons. That whole super predator myth came about. And you were born in the midst of this when the prison population is going from about 300,000 in 1972 to 2.3 million today. And you were just kind of caught up in that. And I really don't think people can appreciate what it was like to be a 13-year-old boy thrown into this system, told you were going to die in prison. And I guess my first question is, when did it hit you? When did you begin to appreciate that you were in something so much more tragic, so much more overwhelming than you'd ever been before? What point in the process did that really start to hit you and begin to overwhelm you?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I've never been asked that like that before. I can honestly say it didn't register that they had sentenced me to die in prison until I was well into my late 20s, early 30s. It didn't register with my parents, because I remember getting a letter from my mom that said something like, the 3 years mandatory that the judge gave you is over. Why aren't you home yet? Right. Mm-hmm. People would ask me, you're not doing good enough. Your behavior doesn't, it's when you're coming home, are you? They didn't understand that no matter how good I was, that did not change my life sentence in prison. So it was much later in my 20s and my 30s before I began to reconcile that, hey, these people didn't sentence me to life. They sentenced me to death in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting to hear you talk about that. And that was something I also wanted to talk about. You know, you put in your book, and this was really powerful, and I thought it was so great that you talked about your life in Tampa before the crime, before the arrest, and the challenges that you were facing then. And I just would like for you to kind of talk to people about what your life was like as a child before this incident ever took place.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. I'm getting old, right? I'm 44. But I'll do my best to remember. I had when I think of my childhood, the first thing that pops in my mind is my grandmother. Because she gave me the type of unconditional love and care and concern that I wish all children had. She was my protector. She was my guardian angel. I grew up in a place called Central Park Village. The Central Park I grew up in is a lot different than the Central Park that other guys, people in the audience might be familiar with. The only time we're running and jogging is when we're trying to get away from the police, you know, much different than the Central Park in New York. I went to Catholic school for the first grade, second grade, and then half of third grade. You know, my grandmother seen something in me that she wanted to try to nurture and protect me, but I was in a hurry to get to public school and be with my regular friends. I got tired of wearing the strict blue uniform that you was required to wear in Catholic school, you know? I didn't understand why they was putting these ashes in the middle of my head when I was going to Catholic school. But I did, when I was going to Catholic school and go to Sunday service, they used to give these kids these little white disc thing to eat. And I wanted to eat one so bad just to see what it tastes like. And then when I went to my mother to ask her to go to the church with me so I can have one of these things, because only the kids' parents who brought them to school or who went to church with them could have it, she told me, boy, that ain't nothing but some damn bread. If you want some bread, go in the kitchen and get it. You know, I'm like, you know, it was a complicated a childhood. I lived a complicated childhood. You know, there was abuse. But one thing that stands out in my mind from that time, and it's an early age, is just my grandmother's unconditional love.
It's so interesting to me to hear you say that, because I know how much your grandmother meant to you, and I know how she became an anchor for you, but you were surrounded by so much trauma and abuse, and your mother went to jail, and there was violence here, and family members going to jail, and family members going to prison. And what's interesting to me about what you're saying is that, but what we hold on to is the love, right? That's the thing, the violence, the distress, the chaos, that's all happening around us, but that's not what's significant. What's significant is the love. And I'm just curious if you've ever thought about, if you could find the 13-year-old Ian a month before any of this stuff happens, if you could find him, what would you say to him? What would you try to persuade him to think about?
That's a tough question. You know, that's a difficult question, because I always say that, you know, my life was meant to be and unfold as it unfolded, and I wouldn't change a thing. Despite all the pain and suffering that I went through, it molded me into the person I am today. But if I could talk to that little 13-year-old child, I would tell him to slow down.
Yeah.
Don't be in a rush to grow up so fast. Enjoy these young, tender years, because once you're older and you can't never get that fountain of youth back. Like Ponce de Leon, according to what they taught us in social studies class, was Ponce de Leon came to Florida looking for the fountain of youth, right? He never found it. And so when you get up in the 40s and the 50s, man, you just realize that, wow, man, I wish I would have took my time and enjoyed my childhood more, because they stripped me of my childhood by casting me into prison at such a young age. I had to grow up fast. Yeah. Faster than I even wanted to.
Yeah. It's it's, I think, really important that you detail the process that you went through when you got to prison. And just so people are clear about this, so what's happening in the United States in the 1990s, you have, you know, these criminologists going around saying that some children aren't really children, that they look like kids, they sound like kids, they act like kids, but they're not kids. And they came up with this label. They said these are, quote, super predators. We have to treat them like they're something else. And what states start doing is lowering the minimum age for trying children as adults. They start putting kids in adult jails and prisons. Florida still has no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. And you and I have talked about this. I've represented 9 and 10-year-old kids down there who are facing adult prosecution. And when people hear about a 13-year-old going to court, they don't realize that when that child is prosecuted as an adult and sentenced as an adult, they send them to the adult prison. And I would love to just hear you talk about that process, because now you're like 14 going on and you're going into an adult prison. What did the prison administrator say to you about your time there, and what happened after you got there?
So that's a great question. And first I want to, you know, say that that law that you're talking about that's still on the books, I know it like the back of my hand. It says a child of any age that's indicted for a life or death felony shall be treated in every respect as if he were an adult. And there's no age limit on it. You could be 8, 9, 10, whatever, and they're going to throw you away.
And can I just say this thing? Because when we were arguing the case at the U.S. Supreme Court, I remember the Supreme Court justice is asking the lawyer for the state of Florida. So you're saying it doesn't matter how young the child is. And they were like a child of 10. And the lawyer was like, yep, a child of 8. And the lawyer was like, yeah. And a child of 6. And the lawyer was like, yes, they can be prosecuted. I remember there was a gasp in the audience. And that was like almost, 10 years ago. But it's still the law.
It's still the law. And it's something I'm working on, going to be working on changing. As long as I live, I want to change that law. And I want to change youth being placed in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, when I first got to prison on my first day, they placed me in solitary confinement on my first day. And you might like, what did you do? I didn't do anything. I was born in 1977 and I went to prison in 1991. That's what I did. I was 14 years old and they required you to be like 18 to be placed in open population. I was so small, they didn't have any clothes to fit me, And so they placed me on a wing called K-Wang at the time. It was very a confinement setting. Ain't no other way to put it. It was a confinement setting. And they put me there at first. And then after I did my 3 weeks there, I was transferred to adult population. And once I was placed in the adult population, I was given most all the responsibilities of an adult. Most, I say most, because I still couldn't buy cigarettes, right? I didn't smoke, but in prison, cigarettes are like commerce. They're what you use to trade. And so it's, I was in unauthorized areas. I walk in the grass when I'm supposed to walk on the sidewalk. The officers would yell at me, I'd yell back. Typical teenage behavior, but I wasn't treated like a child because if I was in society and I did that, they would put me, my mom would, ground me, take my phone away or take my my video games away. In prison, the only thing they had for me was confinement. So they placed me in confinement and I received excessive disciplinary reports. The next thing you know, they said I was a management problem and sentenced me to long-term solitary confinement at age 15.
Yeah. Tell us about that. You're in a cell that's like what, the size of an elevator? What's in your cell? What's the daily routine?
The daily routine is to fight off the monotony, the break out of the boredom. There's a bunk. If you're lucky and you have a mattress that they haven't stripped you of, you have clothes. You have your Bible. No matter what status you're on, they always let you have your Bible, your Quran, depending on what your religion is. You have a pencil. You have a pen or a piece of paper, a rubber pen, so you don't hurt yourself with it. And so for me, my daily routine was to write. I wrote. I set up like obstacle courses in my cell. What you mean? How can you set up an obstacle course in your cell? Well, I rewrite Tupac's poems. I rewrite Langston Hughes' poems. I rewrite Maya Angelou's Still I Rise. I challenge myself and tell myself, Ian, if you don't have what it takes, because I had these fantasies of getting out and being this big superstar, I was powerless, so I constantly dreamed of power. When you're stripped of the lowest degree of things, you want the opposite of what you have access to. And so I started rewriting these guys' poetry and I started sharing them with my fellow prisoners. And the prisoners are tough. They are tougher than Simon Cowell or Sandman on Apollo. They're very, very tough. But these guys would respond to my poetry as if it was the best thing they ever heard. I mean, they would shout, they would clap, they would kick. And this was coming from guys that who had been broken, who had been abandoned, who had been sentenced to life, sentenced to death, guys that just the world had gave up on, whose hearts were hardened. And if I could reach them, they say in New York, you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. But I felt opposite, that if you could make it in prison, you could make it anywhere, because those guys was hard to reach.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's clear that poetry was so critical and essential. And I actually think this would be an appropriate time for people to get some exposure to your poem. You know, the first time you recited a poem for me, I was stunned, not only because it was smart and thoughtful, but it had beauty in it. It revealed these emotions that I thought were just so illuminating. I didn't feel like I was really seeing you until I heard those poems, and you would recite some on the phone and you would type them. I'd love for you to just share one with our audience now, just so they can get a sense of what it was that was sustaining you during this time.
Yeah, I'll start with the poem, "My Time Will Come," the title of my book. And it says, "I promise you, the brunt of my oppression has a purpose. And this same person that you persecute will one day be worshipped. Though I stand before you bare-chested and shirtless, with my soul and emotions naked, just wanting to be nurtured. Yeah, despite the desperation, desertion, and hurting, my time gonna come. Though I composed this poem not knowing if I'll ever be able to perform it in an auditorium, I do it with the faith of a poet that believes he was born to do it. Like an acorn caught up in a storm, flung from the branch where it was born. You can only hold me back for so long. My time gonna come. Despite the difficulties and disappointments, my determination remains undaunted. Though the waters of my tomorrows are deep and uncharted, the buoyance of my character will float unwavering towards them, like a song written yet unrecorded. My time gonna come. Though you wrapped me in chains and sprayed me with chemical flames and did all of the things you did to add to my pain, my circumstances will change. I believe this with the depths of my being, that as long as this world continues to spin, it cannot end until it's been enjoyed by Ian. Remember this day, because things won't always be this way. My time gonna come. My time gonna come. Against all conceivable odds, my time gonna come." Thank you.
It's so powerful. It's so powerful. And, you know, when I hear you, Ian, I think about the entire struggle for freedom, because you and I are the descendants of people who were enslaved in this country. They were brought here in chains, kidnapped and trafficked, and brutalized and tormented and tortured, and told that they were less than fully human, told that they were not worthy of freedom, not deserving, not capable. And that narrative, not unlike the narrative that they gave to you, was a narrative that they had to reject to survive. They had to actually believe things they hadn't seen. And we wouldn't be here if they hadn't found a way to love despite the brutality and the tragedy of slavery. And then, you know, I think about what happens after that, when people were promised freedom, emancipation, and they thought they were going to get the things they wanted, but they didn't. The courts withdrew, the Congress withdrew. And for a century, Black people were pulled out of their homes and beaten and tortured and burned to death and lynched on courthouse lawns. And yet they had this hope that one day they'd get to a better place. And 6 million Black people fled the American South and went to the North and West places. The Black folks in LA, you know, most of them didn't go there as immigrants. They came there as refugees and exiles from the American South and Detroit and Cleveland and Chicago. But they always had this hope that something better was waiting for them. And I'm in Montgomery, you've been in Montgomery, you spent time here. And this is a city rich with that history. And I've been thinking about that during the pandemic, because I know that we stand on the shoulders of people who did so much more with so much less. I mean, the Black folks that protested for our rights to vote and freedom would put on their Sunday best and they'd get beaten and brutalized, but they knew that something better could happen. And today, when I hear you recite that, it's almost like you're speaking for generations of people
who've had to endure the hardship of injustice and inequality. And it moves me because it affirms what people have been saying for generations, that oppression cannot last forever. Injustice cannot last forever. And you just have a beautiful way of personalizing it that inspires other people. And it inspired me when I met you, and it continues to inspire me. You were going through a lot in solitary, and I'd like you to explain to people how solitary works, because it's sort of like a trap. You know, to get out of it, you have to be perfect, but they keep doing things that make it impossible to get perfect. I'd like you to explain how it works and where you were when we met in that journey of trying to recover from those conditions.
Yeah, so I was at, you wanna talk about how we met first, or you wanna?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, great. So I was at Union Correctional Institution, AKA The Rock, one day, and the officer came and knocked on my door and said, "Ian Manuel, you got legal mail, so you have to sign for your legal letter." And I seen it was a letter from Montgomery, Alabama. And I'm like, I don't know nobody in Alabama who's contacting me. So I opened this letter up. It had a red, the EJI red insignia on the front of the letter. And I opened it up, and I have the letter here with me. It's dated October 25th, 2006. Mm-hmm. Show the audience. And it said, "Dear Mr. Manuel, I am the director of a nonprofit law firm called the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. We have a staff of attorneys who provide legal representation to people in prison. We have primarily handled death penalty cases for the last 20 years. However, we recently began a project providing legal assistance to individuals who have been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole as juveniles after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Roper versus Simmons, banning the death penalty for juveniles. We started working on the cases of prisoners who were sentenced to life without parole at a young age. In identifying young people sentenced to life imprisonment without parole for offenses committed at age 14 or younger, we spotted your case. We believe that there may be a chance to reverse a sentence of life imprisonment without parole under an analysis that flows from the Roper decision, and wanted to know if you'd be interested in meeting with us to discuss this possibility." How many people in the audience would have been interested at that point? "As you know, post-conviction litigation is very time sensitive, with lots of procedural defaults and statutes of limitations that can bar review of claims. We are also limited in how many cases we can take on. However, a distant review of your case suggests that we might be able to offer some legal assistance if you're interested, and will get in touch with us quickly. We are a nonprofit organization and do not charge anyone we represent a fee for the legal assistance we provide. If you do not currently have a legal representation, we would like to discuss obtaining legal assistance. I'd like you to please call my office at 334-269-1803 as soon as possible." You might start getting a lot of new calls. "As soon as possible. In addition to practicing law, I'm also a law professor at the New York University School of Law, and I'm frequently out of the office. If I'm not able to speak, please ask to speak to Aaron Ewell or Rebecca Kiley, who are attorneys working with me on this project. I include some information about our project with a self-addressed stamp envelope. All the best. Sincerely, Brian A. Stevenson, Executive Director." So I get this letter from you when I'm in confinement. I'm under duress. I'm under stress. All my appeals have been denied. I have a life sentence without the possibility of parole. I've been hurting myself. The staff have been hurting me. And all of a sudden, this letter comes in my cell like manna from heaven. It's like God is sending his own soldier to come free me. And so I convinced the lieutenant to give me a phone call. I'll never forget that first phone call, because one of your staff member picked up the phone. Linda passed the call through to Aaron. And Aaron was like, "Where are you calling from?" Because you was a small law firm at the time. And it was like, she was like, we are a small law firm. We can't represent anybody in Florida. Like I said, I'm telling you, I got a letter from the guy who says he's the executive director of EJI. She said, what's the name on the letter? I said, Brian Stevenson. And she patched me through to you. Yeah. And I'll never forget, it was jazz playing. It was Kareem Bailey Ray.
That's right.
Kareem Bailey Ray was playing on the intercom, and we talked, and you gave me your word. You said that you would send two lawyers down to see me, and you sent Rachel Germany and Irene Joe down to see me, man. And you've been my lawyer ever since, man. And I'll be forever thankful for you rescuing me.
Yeah, well, I can't tell you how excited and how honored I have been to work with somebody like you. And it was your spirit and the things you were dealing with. And you detail a lot of this in the book because, you know, it's not just the physical environment of solitude and isolation. It's also you've got people who don't actually see you as fully human. They're interacting with you in ways that are abusive. And I'd like you to talk about that a little bit because I just don't think people appreciate that being in solitary isn't just being isolated. You've got all these other human actors that are aggravating and making the conditions worse. What happened to you in that circumstance that aggravated your conditions?
Well, you would have officers that would write false disciplinary reports. Okay, to explain, it takes 18 perfect months to be released out of solitary confinement. You have to do 6 months. So I want the audience to imagine an elevator with three levels. Level one, level two, floor one, floor two, floor three. And in order to go from floor one to floor two, you have to do 6 months in this elevator on the first floor. Yeah. Now, imagine living in this elevator and not causing any problems, but they come and they're rattling in the cage. The officers, they are rattling in the cage. You go out that elevator to go take a shower and they find a magazine that someone's let you read that has their name on it and not your name on it. And they write you a disciplinary report. That's an additional 6 months on the first floor. So by happenstance, just say you do six perfect months on the first floor, six perfect months on the second floor, and you make it to the third floor and you're hoping the doors open, but you get 5 months and 29 days in and the officer that remembers you from when you were on the first floor, knows you're about to get off of solitary, he writes you a disciplinary report saying you threaten him. A spoken threat is one of the most serious DRs you can receive in prison. So guess what? You don't go back down to level two. You go all the way back down to level one and start over again. And it's a total lie. And so I was caught in that midst, going up and down this elevator that just didn't want to never stop and the doors that didn't never want to open. And I remember telling the federal judge once we took them to trial for the cruel and unusual conditions of CMs, he said, Mr. Manuel, why have you been in solitary so long? I say, the way the system is set up, you know, the months turn to years and the years turn to decades. I did decades and I still have friends like Michael McKinney, who's been in solitary in Florida for 25 years, or Daryl Streeter, who I wrote about in my New York Times op-ed, who's been in solitary for 26 years, or Demetrius McCutcheons, who I've left behind and still stuck in solitary. Something has to change, man. It has to be a cap placed on solitary confinement for adults, and it needs to be totally eliminated for children.
I remember just the anguish and the difficulty, and it did seem like a game. It was like every time you got close, it would just get pulled away.
Yes.
And I know that because I think a lot of people hearing you talk about that would say, I just don't know if I could have done that. How much total time did you do in solitary?
I did total, I did 18 consecutive years, but 20 years total.
Yeah, a lot of people hear them, they say, I just don't think I could do that. But you had your creativity, you had your poetry. We would talk sometimes on the phone and you would say, I've made up some advertising for these different brands. And you would go through these different brands. You said, but this is what they should be saying. Beer commercials and shoe stores. And it would always be brilliant stuff. And I was hoping that you would share another poem because I know that it was during this period that you were so prolific. I mean, you would sometimes send me letters that had like 8 or 9 poems, and Mariah would get some, and you were just prolific.
And I'd love for you to share a poem from that time when you were dealing with that elevator that just would never let you out.
Yeah, I like to share the poem every time I breathe. And I came up with this poem because in prison, they use PBS as a punishment. Like, prisoners like to watch sports and entertainment. So if you're going to force them to do their job and let you out of your cell for an hour to watch this television, your punishment was for the television to be placed on PBS. And so, yeah, because it's supposed to be boring. Well, it backfired on them this day because there was a show on about three South Bronx teenagers who learned to express themselves through slam poetry. And I was so engaged because I had never seen anything like it. I had only been exposed to the written language of poetry, the academic poetry. So I'm seeing this poetry and I couldn't wait to get back. And the officers are walking by and they're expecting me to have my head down and be bored, but I'm locked in on the TV and they don't understand what's going on. But I did. And I went back in my cell and I wrote this poem called Every Time I Breathe. And it says, every time I breathe, I feel the need to justify my existence, to take this moment that I'm living and enjoy every millisecond in it. My life and my struggles, not many can comprehend it. My desire for freedom burns like a sausage inside a skillet. Tomorrow isn't promised, so I'm thankful for this minute. Though in prison, merely existing, it's like my life has been suspended. But that means it's temporary because I haven't been expelled. And I still got a chance as long as I can in and exhale every time I breathe. Every time I breathe, I'm thankful for the oxygen from the trees and little things like little bees that get overlooked until they sting. Every day I'm faced with obstacles that block the progress to my dreams. But the blockades only masquerades like costumes on Halloween. I've been through enough pain to make a sane man just scream. But instead, I take a deep breath and just breathe. Every time I breathe, the cosmos come out of my nostrils like particles of product coming out of your console. My soul is like a chihuahua you didn't include in your carpool. My lungs relax and collapse like a bottom sitting on a bar stool. Every time I breathe, I become an intergalactic being, stepping out of character like a chiropractor, snapping peas. I prayed so many times, it's like I got arthritis in my knees, but I still get down and bow my head because I continue to believe that as long as I can breathe, God's gonna make a change. And my circumstances are only chances for me to glorify his name. You don't know me, homie, but there's odds I've already overcame. So if praying works, but hurts, then I can stand a little pain. I want to end this part by thanking God for bringing me to these heights. And I make a promise to always honor and cherish this breath of life. Every time I breathe. Every time I breathe, every time I breathe. Woo!
Yeah, man. Yeah. You know, what's so incredibly powerful to me is that, you know, your poetry speaks to lots of people in lots of situations. People who've never been to prison, people have not gone through, but you speak a kind of a universal love and a universal truth. And it's what hit me when I first heard your poem. It wasn't poetry just for that space. It was poetry for the human experience, for the human struggle. And what I love about your book, which I'm just going to now just make sure that people understand, there is a book. If you haven't bought the book, you should buy the book. Because not only do you hear Ian's powerful story, but you also get to read some of his extraordinary poetry. And when you read the poetry, you'll begin to understand that, you know, this is a poet speaking to the human experience, to the human struggle. And regardless if you have a similar a story or situation or a very different one, it speaks to you.
you've always thought outside the box a little bit. You've always been willing to kind of think through things and imagine things that other people don't. And you did something very outside the box after you'd been in prison, and you called the woman that you shot. And just so people understand, so Ian was encouraged by some older kids to try to do this robbery. He has a gun, completely overwhelmed by the situation. The people react. He ends up shooting a woman. It's non-lethal, but she gets shot in the face. She recovers. He's charged with attempted murder in addition to armed robbery, and that's a whole nother thing. He's sentenced to life without parole. And then one day, you decide to call the woman that you shot. Yeah. And I'd like you to talk about why you did that and what happened when you did.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I think, and I tell people this during my public speaking, that all human beings have this thing inside of us that will urge us to do something. And we usually push that down or push that thought, oh, that's a crazy idea. It'll never happen. Well, in this instance, I've learned to pay attention to those little tugs at the heart because they usually lead somewhere. And I was sitting down, my lawyer at the time, a guy by the name of Brian Gonzalez, a different Brian, had sent me all of my legal work and basically told me that we had each reached the end of the road. There was nothing more we could do. And I sat there going through all the paperwork he had sent me. And I noticed that in there was the police report with Debbie's name, address, and phone number. Mm-hmm. And I just got, something said, Ian, call Debbie. And in my childlike imagination, something was saying, pretend to be the detective, pretend to be the arresting officer that arrested you. And maybe she'll accept the call. But then something said, Ian, that if you want this to work, you have to tell the truth. So I went out into the compound and I picked up the phone. And back then you could call the live operator by pressing zero. Just pressing zero and you get a live operator. And an operator came on and I said, could you dial this number and say, collect call from Ian. Well, a telephone rang for a few rings. And then a lady picked up on the other line and said, can you ask him his last name? And so I had to say it. I said, Manuel. And she said, yeah, yes, I accept. And so we had this conversation. I don't remember everything that was said, but I do remember the first thing I said. I said, Miss Bagley, I'd like to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas, because it was Christmas time, 1991. I'd like to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas, and I'd like to apologize for shooting you in the face. And then Debbie asked me something that no 14-year-old should ever have to answer. She said, Ian, why did you shoot me? And I just remember saying, it was a mistake. It all happened so fast. And so we talked, and then the 15 minutes was up, and I asked, could I call back? And she said, yes. And I called her back, and I don't remember much from that second conversation except me asking her, could I write her? Because I felt like I wanted to have a connection with this lady, because my grandmother didn't raise me to hurt people. And I called her. I mean, I wrote her, and that's how our correspondence started. And we corresponded off and on for about 7 or 8 years until her family and her friends got in her head. She had to resist people calling her crazy, like, this guy tried to kill you. What are you doing? But she continued to come to court, show up in court. Every time I had a resentencing hearing to show her support, she would sit behind the defense and not the state. She would go on the shows like the Today Show and say, this sentence is cruel and unusual. She'd go in the New York Times and say, had he been a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white kid, he would not have received a life sentence. And that took courage for her to do. She yeah. received a lot of pushback on that, and I'm forever grateful that she did that.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, the relationship that you all developed. And we were skeptical, I'll be honest, because we just don't meet a lot of people who do that. But she was so enthusiastic and so genuine. When you got out, we honored both of you together at our benefit. She came to New York, and it was just really extraordinary to see that. And I appreciate you talking about it and writing about it, because I think one of the things that when we talk about
criminal justice policies, when we talk about our legal system, when we talk about crime, you know, one of my great frustrations is that we have sentencers and policymakers and judges that act as if you can put crimes in prison. You know, these sentences are written like you can put a crime in prison, but you can't put a crime in prison. You put people in prison, right? And you and I know that people are not crimes. And you have to treat people differently than you treat a crime.
Yes.
What I love about what happens between you and Debbie is that there is compassion, there is forgiveness, there is a possibility for redemption. And I just am totally persuaded that we will not become a healthy society, a healthy community, until we open our hearts to what it means to practice compassion and forgiveness. And nobody talks about it. You know, with too few people are talking about what does it mean to be compassionate? What does it mean to be forgiven? And one of the things that has struck me is that even when you were in prison, and certainly since you've been out, you've had that kind of heart too. You're always saying, hey man, I need you to look into this case and look into that case. And I am looking into a couple of those, which we haven't had a chance to talk about.
Right.
And I heard you say earlier, I left these folks behind. And for you, it feels like you have this spirit, this desire to help other people. And I'd love you to talk about that. You know, this the hope you have, the vision you have, the aspirations you have to help other people.
Yeah, it goes back to the dreams and ask. Someone asked me the other day, matter of fact, Scott Simon asked me today during an NPR interview, what will it take for you to be happy? Only I know, in doing those 18 years in that solitary confinement cell, the conversations I had with God.
Yeah.
Only I know, pacing back and forth in that cell, the dreams and aspirations that I developed. And what it's difficult to say when I'll be happy, but I do know that I want my people free. Yeah. I want to see the way solitary confinement is structured, changed throughout the country. I want to see that law in Florida that sent me to prison when I was a 13-year-old child. I want to see that taken off the books and a cap put on that. I want to be able to go back into the prisons that said I was worthless and would die there. I mean, I remember talking to a therapist and telling her some of my hopes and aspirations of getting out and making a book, publishing a book and having a movie made about my life and coming back into the prisons and changing the ways they ran it. And she said, Ian, you're a pretty smart kid. Work on getting out of solitary and becoming a teacher's aide. That is as far as they could see of someone like me. Getting out of solitary and being a teacher's aide was what my intelligence was, as far as they could see me going. So I wanna, yes, I have a capacity to help people. And it be honest with you, it hurts me when I see people that don't have that same type of love for the human spirit. You know, I have friends that I'll drop everything I'm doing if I'm with them to take a call from a prisoner. And they're like, man, what's wrong with you? You know, why would you do that? Because I know what it's like to be on the other end of that call and you're sorry, your call's not accepted, or the call goes straight to voicemail. It hurts, man. And yeah. So I just want, if I can stop someone from suffering, Martin Luther King said, if I can help someone as I pass along, if I can cheer someone with a word of song, if I can show someone that traveling wrong, then my living would not be in vain,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what I want, man. That's what'll make me happy.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful, it's beautiful. And I just wanna say to the audience, there are specific policies that Bodhia and I are fighting to change. First of all, there should be no life without parole for children in this country. And we've gotten close, but we're having setbacks. And so we need people to keep talking about that and making sure that the prosecutors and the judges in your community, if you don't know who your district attorney is, if you don't know who the people who make the decisions about how people are prosecuted, you need to know, and you need to hold them accountable. On any given day, there are thousands of children under the age of 18 in adult jails and prisons where they're at great risk of sexual abuse, where they're at great risk of suicide, where they're at great risk of all these things. And our government, no government should be authorized to put children in adult jails and prisons. Ian and I believe that you shouldn't prosecute children as adults. We think all children are children. And I certainly believe that you don't judge a commitment to children by looking at how well you treat talented kids and gifted kids and privileged kids. We have to look at how we're
dealing with children by looking at kids that are struggling, kids that have fallen down, kids that are in detention facilities. And these are policies that people listening have the power to impact. And I just want to encourage everybody to get educated about this topic and to begin to advocate this punitive approach that we see in schools and in jails. And it's what's created the conditions that so many of Ian's friends are still dealing with and what he dealt with all of those years. You describe your release, and I remember getting a call, like it was an hour by hour. I was like, well, are you all out of the court yet? And they were like, no. And I said, well, call me back. And are you all in this place? And no. And you came to Montgomery. I'd like you to talk about that, because after all of that time, I just would love to hear you reflect on what it was like to finally get to the point where you could hold on to the freedom that you'd been writing about, dreaming about for so long.
Yeah, man. It was something so touching, man. Like, you don't know what it's like to run a race and finally get to the finish line, man. Like, to break that tape of freedom, man. And yeah, it was like, man, I can't, it's indescribable, man. It's something that you have to go through yourself to finally realize, but because it was setback after setback, but to finally realize, then I came to Montgomery because all my family had died in Florida. There was no one for me to go home to. And I came to Montgomery for the reentry program that you guys, great reentry program you guys have set up in Alabama. And I had to get used to things like crossing the streets again. Like, I was terrified of the oncoming cars. I had difficulty at first finding housing because they don't want to rent to a convicted felon. But I ended up with some great landlords who named Cindy and Robert Thornhill, who did rent to me. And I'll be forever grateful for that. And we developed a friendship. She became like a extended family to me, my landlord driving me to do my laundry or driving me to get my groceries. And then the lawyers that, you know, went to law school for law, they are teaching me how to cook. I still don't know how to cook, by the way, but they sure tried. They sure tried. Or me trying to learn how to drive a car, which I'm still trying to learn. You know, I'm in New York, really don't need it yet. But the reentry process is a struggle, man. And I think that might be one of my strong suits that I work on too, because reentry is a difficult process and it's not something that is just over. Like, it's because it's a rebirth. It's not like a time limit on it. You know what I'm saying? People might think after 6 months or a year, he's fine. But actually, I might be 19 because I've been out 5 years, right? I might be 19 mentally and emotionally. Physically, I'm a 44-year-old man, but I'm still developing me as I learn this new life that I've re-entered the world, you know?
Yeah, well, I do know, and I hope people appreciate what you're saying, because you're absolutely right. You can't go through what you've been through and just kind of brush it off, right? It's a struggle. And then, like you said, you stepped into a completely different world.
Yes.
2016 than the world you left in 1990, and all of those things that happened in between. People assume, oh, he should know how to do that, and he should know how to do that. And I remember just kind of using computers and all of that kind of stuff. I want to say this to you, Ian, because I know our time is running short. You've done beautifully. You've done so beautifully, and you make me so proud. I'm trying not to cry in front of all these people, but you do.
Right. Thank you, man. Thank you,
bro. Make me so proud. And I just think the only way we can end this conversation is by having you end it with another poem. But I tell people all the time, I'm just so proud of you and so inspired by you. And I can't wait to see you. This pandemic has been a challenge for everybody. But I want to encourage you, hang in there. This is a tough process. We have to do all these interviews and all that, but you're doing great. You're doing amazing. And people are reacting in such a beautiful way. And I love you. And it's always, always a thrill to spend time talking with you. But I think we should end the night with the thing that makes your book so extraordinary, and that's your writing, these beautiful, beautiful poems. So if you would, end us tonight with one more poem, please.
I'll end it with the poem that you put in your book, Just Mercy. I still remember you writing me, asking me for permission to include Uncried Tears in your book when I was still in solitary. And I couldn't believe you was asking me for permission when you had took my case for free. But I was so grateful because you said, Ian, now you are published, you will be a published poet, and it'll be easier for me to present you as such when I try to get some of your work in published now. And so I'll end it with Uncried Tears. It says, imagine teardrops left uncried from pain trapped inside, waiting to escape through the windows of your eyes. Why won't you let us out? The tears question the conscience. Relinquish your fears and doubts and heal yourself in the process. The conscience told the tears, I know you really want me to cry, but in releasing you from bondage and gaining your freedom, you die. The tears gave it some thought before giving the conscience an answer. If crying brings you to triumph, then dying's not such a disaster. Uncried tears. And we'll end on that.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ian Manuel, his book is My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. Buy it. Thank you, Ian. Thank you all. Always a thrill to be with my friend Ian Manuel. Good night, everybody. This has been such a thrill. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.